Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. From kangaroos bred in captivity to trained tigers, exotic pets come from all walks of wildlife. And ownership of wild animals is increasingly becoming a hot debate. Exotic pet owners defend their right to care for critters from venomous snakes to angry chimps. Animal rights advocates, meanwhile, are doing what they can to stop the purchase of exotic pets and to place current ones into safe, accredited sanctuaries. However, both camps appear to share a love of wild animals. Joining us is Lauren Slater, an animal lover herself, who wrote about the exotic animal ownership debate for National Geographic. Lauren Slater, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you looked into some of the motivations for why people buy and keep exotic pets. What did you find?
I found that there were a couple of different motivations. I mean, the ones that come immediately to my mind are some people buy exotic pets as a sort of status symbol, you know, keeping up with the Joneses type of thing. If the neighbor has, you know, a Bengal cat, then the other person's going to go out and purchase a cougar, you know, just to one-up them sort of thing. And while that sounds strange, that really is a motivation. I mean, there's something exotic and certainly expensive about having, say, a wild cat. But the most common motivation had to do with people falling in love with these animals when they're babies, the mammals especially, like the tigers and the cat. And then taking them home and raising them. The problem, of course, comes in these animals don't stay babies. They grow up and they reach sexual maturity, and then oftentimes problems begin.
Right. They sort of treat them as surrogate children. And eventually, I guess, these children have to be sometime declawed or defanged.
Yeah, and even then, you can declaw, defang, de-whatever your exotic or wild animal, but you can't take its genetic material out of it. And I'm thinking of Michelle Burke, who I interviewed, who had a kinkajou, which is a relatively small animal, wild animal. And the kinkajou's name was Winnie, and she was a beloved family pet. They actually bought her on Craigslist, and they dressed her up in clothes and, you know, anthropomorphized her in all sorts of ways. And then Winnie, at some point, you know, a couple of years down the road, went into her first heat, and she started attacking them and also attacking herself out of just sheer kind of hormonal frustration. Mm. And that was a terrifying experience for the family. This beloved, you know, sweet kinkajou just became a raging monster, and they gave her up after that.
But there are some very gruesome tales of exotic animals turning on their owners. Apparently there's a database. What can you tell us about that, and what kind of things get recorded?
Well, first of all, that database is at Born Free USA, and you can go online and look it up. But the first thing you need to know about that database is it's probably radically incomplete. Born Free USA only reports on reported incidences. It's safe to assume that the vast majority of these incidences go unreported. So obviously Born Free USA has no way of knowing how many, you know, violent incidences actually occur with exotic animals as pets. Mm. You know, again, they report on the ones that make it into the news or the newspaper. And even with that severe limitation on what they can list, there's still, you go on that site and you look at the incidences and it's, you know, someone in Arizona was gutted to death by his kangaroo, you know, by his pet kangaroo. Someone had their hand bitten off by a bear. You know, three venomous snakes were found in the, you know, waiting area of the airport. And the list goes on and on.
Wow. Well, what are the current regulations for purchasing and caring for exotic animals?
Well, I think one of the problems with the regulations is that they're not at all consistent from state to state. I live in Massachusetts, and in Massachusetts, it's 100%, it's clear, it's 100% illegal to have any kind of wild animal. as a pet. And I think it's the same for New Hampshire. But, for instance, in Ohio, there used to be no regulations on whether or not you could have wild animals. And Ohio, in fact, is full of people who have wild or exotic animals as pets.
Remind us of the story, that gruesome story in Ohio from a couple years ago that set the regulations off.
A man named Jerry Thompson had a menagerie of wild animals on his property. And that actually is not so uncommon. These people who have wild animals as pets will sometimes actually kind of collect them. So he had a large collection of wild animals, tigers, other kinds of large cats, zebras. I mean, it was truly a menagerie. And for whatever reason, and no one really knows what his motivations were, what was going on with him, he let them all loose, you know, 20 or 30 of these wild animals that were living in enclosures on his property in Zanesville, Ohio. Zanesville is not the country, it's a suburb. He let them all loose, and then he killed himself. He shot himself. There were people going to work in Zanesville, and the animals were running in front of cars, and there was a good chance they were going to attack, you know, an unsuspecting citizen. So the sheriff's department really felt they had no choice but to slaughter all of the animals to kill them.
So as a result, Ohio's kind of clamping down on the exotic pet ownership. What are they doing?
Well, the first thing I think they did was they made it illegal to have wild animal auctions. And now they are requiring that all wild animal owners register their animals with a central registry and also pay something like $3 to $5 million in insurance to have these animals, which makes it pretty much impossible to have. I mean, not many people can afford to buy insurance like that.
We're speaking with Lauren Slater. She's an author of several books and also an article in the current National Geographic about exotic animal ownership and the debate going on in several places about whether or not people should be allowed to keep exotic animals. Lauren, you write in your article that it's believed that more exotic animals live in American homes than are cared for in American zoos. What is the case that wild animal owners are making for why they should be allowed to keep these animals?
Well, there's a group called REXANA, which stands for Responsible Exotic Animal Ownership. The case that they make and the case that other people who own these exotic animals would make is that, number one, the number of violent incidences that happen with these exotic animals is actually lower than the number of violent incidences that happen with domestic animals. Hmm. So if you go on Born Free USA's website and you look at their incidences of wild animal attacks on human beings, you'll find, you know, hundreds of incidences listed there, but there are more incidences of people visiting the ER for, say, dog bites. Hmm. The other argument that they make is that it's, you know, it's within their rights as, you know, a United States citizen to own these animals, and restricting them from owning them is in interfering with their, you know, personal freedom that comes with being a citizen of the United States. And a third argument would be that wild animals have been kept by humans and human civilizations for as long as civilization has been around, which is about 12 or 13,000 years. So there's a long history to this, you know. But again, it comes back to the baseline argument, is that it's no more or less safe or unsafe than having a dog or a cat.
How about the argument against wild animal ownership made by animal rights activists?
Well, there's a lot of arguments, but I think the first one is that there is a big difference between a domesticated and a wild animal. Of all of the large land mammals that roam this earth, and there are, you know, hundreds, only 13 of them, I think, have been successfully domesticated over thousands and thousands of years. To domesticate an animal takes thousands and thousands of years of culling from the gene pool and selective breeding. So a domesticated animal has a different genome from a wild animal. And when you take a wild animal and put it into a domestic situation, its natural inclinations, its very genetic structure does not mesh with a domestic situation. In other words, it's meant to be a wild animal. It's not meant to live in captivity. It's not going to flourish in captivity, and therefore presents dangers in captivity to both the owner and to the animal. Mm. You know, a couple of years ago, I'm sure some of your listeners, or maybe all of them, heard of the terrible incident with the chimpanzee in Connecticut.
Oh, right. He mauled a woman's face.
Terribly mauled a woman. Now, that chimpanzee, you know, needed to be killed. So, you know, it came to a terrible, terrible end for both the chimpanzee primate and the human primate. So, you know, these are some of the arguments against it. It's not good for humans, and it's not good for animals.
Lauren Slater, thank you for your time today.
Thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
Lauren Slater is the author of several books, including most recently The $60,000 Dog, My Life with Animals. She wrote the article called Wild Obsession, which is about the debate over owning exotic animals. It's in the current issue of National Geographic. We have a link to her article and more, including some fantastic photographs of animals in captivity from the article. All of that is at wordofmouthradio.org. Most Americans don't have to go home to walk the kangaroo or feed the boa constrictor, but we are wild for animals. The American Pets Production Association estimates that 68% of U.S. households own a pet, over 83 million dogs among them. Joining me now is one such dog owner, Word of Mouth producer Taylor Quimby, who's got a little show and tell of sorts, or I don't know, I guess we should call it a play and listen.
Yeah, so I have a dog. She's about 8 pounds. She's half Chihuahua, half something else. We don't know. She's kind of a mutt. And she makes a lot of funny noises, as many pets do, but especially when she's begging for attention, specifically if she wants to be pet, she makes a sound that sounds nothing like a dog. Take a listen.
Objectively, if I was listening to this, it kind of sounds like somebody unzipping a sleeping bag.
It does sound like a zipper, like a tent or a sleeping bag zipper.
It sounds exactly like a tent.
What's your dog's name?
Angel.
All right, we're going to throw the challenge out to you. Does your pet make a weird sound? Maybe your cat sounds something like this. Oh my God. Or maybe your dog sounds something like a woman wailing. Or maybe you have a pet goat and it sounds just like a shouting man.
Oh, that's my favorite one. I hope somebody out there has a pet goat.
Is that real? How can that be real?
Oh, YouTube.
All right, so prove it yourself. Go to the voice memo feature on your smartphone and hit record, or take a video of your pet in action and then send it to us. There are step-by-step instructions to do so on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, thank goodness. It's officially spring, but there is still one winter visitor worth checking out before the snowbanks melt. Local birders have observed a rare influx of snowy owls in the Granite State this year. To find out more, I sat down with Eric Masterson. He's protection specialist with the Harris Center for Conservation Education and author of Birdwatching in New Hampshire. It's a hyper-local guide to the best birding spots and events the state has to offer. Eric, great to have you back with us.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Virginia.
Reports of snowy owls spotted as far south as North Carolina, far east as Bermuda.
Yeah, well, actually, even further than that now, there was a sighting in Florida. You don't think snowy and Florida in the same sentence? So they're coming from the Arctic. They breed along the Arctic Rim up into the Canadian archipelago in the Arctic Ocean, and they migrate south every winter to a varying degree. This winter, just to give you a sense of scale, in New Hampshire, on a single day in December, 12 birds were counted. The previous max in the records is 3 birds. So just an unprecedented invasion.
Well, and then news this week that 100 have been caught at Logan Airport.
That's right, just this winter.
Elsewhere in mass. This was after 3 were killed at JFK Airport by officers there.
Yeah.
That of course, attracted a huge outcry. But what is it about airports that is drawing the snowy owl?
Well, we have dramatically altered the landscape in this region of the continent. The thing about airports is that the grassland habitat mimics what they're used to in the Arctic. And so it's kind of one of the remaining habitats that they would naturally be predisposed to occupying during the winter.
Any theories as to why the sudden increase this year?
So the current thinking is that there was a record bumper crop of lemmings last year in the Arctic, which is a chief food resource for these birds. And so any given year, snowy owls will lay anywhere from 0 to 11 eggs. You know, if their prey is abundant, they can have success with all 11. In rare cases, with all 11 hatching. In years where there's very little food, they can have a bust and not raise any young at all. And last year was a super successful year, and so there was a very high rate of fledging. So all those birds need to disperse in the winter, and they come far. There was more birds to disperse farther south. That was really the reasons for the phenomenal influx, because there was a hugely successful breeding season.
So if we went through the food chain, why so many more lemmings? I'm just wondering, because they are coming from the Arctic Circle, and I know that there's been a great deal of change climatically in the Arctic Circle.
Yeah, and scientists don't really have a good take on that, why lemmings have this huge boom-bust cycle. The owl's cycle is related to the lemmings, but why the lemmings boom-bust is not properly understood at the moment.
Are there so many lemmings here in New Hampshire?
No, we don't have lemmings in New Hampshire.
So I'm guessing they're eating on small mice, rodents, voles.
Yeah, rodents, voles, and actually a lot of seabirds. With recent satellite telemetry, Norm Smith, the chap in Logan, who catches the owls and releases them elsewhere on Plum Island, for instance, has been attaching satellite transmitters. And so we're learning more about their habits. And some birds have been documented going out to sea at night and catching seabirds. And actually, if you spend time on the coast looking for these owls, you can find little graveyards of seabird wings and legs where snowy owls have been feasting during the night.
Tell us a little bit more about the snowy owl, however. How big do they get, and what makes catching sight of them such a unique experience for bird watchers and non-birders?
Well, they're an owl, and so normally owls, you think of, we have about 8 species that have occurred over the course of, history in New Hampshire, and most of those are nocturnal. They're active during the nighttime. Snowy owl is the exception. It's active also during the daytime. And so, it's an owl you can see. It's exotic. It comes from a place that, we don't get to visit. It's huge. It's pretty striking, too, you got to admit, with those big yellow saucer eyes. And you can, because they're from the Arctic, where they're not habituated to humans, they don't have a fear of humans to a great extent. And so you can get incredibly close to them. I'm not advocating people do. They need to rest and refuel when they're here during the winter. But they do allow close approach. And so, they're highly photogenic. People just are attracted to them. What can I say?
Any advice about tracking the snowy owl here in New Hampshire?
Yes. Actually, they'll be departing now towards early April. They'll be heading back north. But there have been a couple of reliable sites to find them in New Hampshire. Probably the best place now is Rye Harbor State Park. It's a tiny little state park just north of the marina. And there has been a bird there for the last 3 months holding court. And it was there as recently as 2 days ago. And Rye Harbor State Park, for folks who don't know, is very small. It's about a 10 or 11 acre park, so you can't miss it. And actually, if you're looking for a snowy owl, don't look for the owl. Look for the photographers, the phalanx of paparazzi that are following this bird around. That's all you need to find. And that's probably the best place. Plum Island is always a good spot, even in down years when there aren't many snowy owls in New England. Plum Island usually has a few. And Salisbury State Park in Massachusetts also is a good spot.
Mm-hmm. Is this the best time in general for bird watchers?
Oh, it is. Especially with the winter we've had. It's been a really cruel winter. I think people are just tired of it. And we're going to be here. We already have seen the first blackbirds returning. And we're going to be seeing phoebes coming very shortly. Bluebirds are starting to nest shortly. And the next 2 months will be tremendously exciting for birdwatching.
Well, you can find out more in Eric Masterson's book, Birdwatching in New Hampshire. Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Virginia. Thanks so much.
Okay, after the break, we're going to move from raptors to retail with an exploration of the elusive no exceptions, no small print satisfaction guarantee. We're also going to test just how far L.L. Bean is willing to go when it comes to product returns. Stay with us for that. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Satisfaction guaranteed. It is a retail promise that usually comes with a good helping of small print, presumably to prevent customers from abusing liberal return policies. Still, a handful of established brands, from L.L. Bean to Nordstrom's, offer a true lifetime guarantee for merchandise with no exceptions. Joining us to contemplate the pros and cons of a promise that you cannot take back is Adweek staff writer Robert Clara. Robert, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
L.L. Bean, the North Face, Land's End, those household utensils with the spongy handles, they're all moderately high-end retailers. At least, let's say they're not bargain basement brands. Does that factor in the ability to offer a lifetime guarantee?
I think it does, yes, because there's a certain article of faith that these brands take when they extend a guarantee like this, and that is that their average customer won't take advantage of them. And if you are a bargain basement brand, I don't think that you can necessarily have the same assurances that a higher-end brand would have.
Well, I think we've all heard the stories, you know, retailers taking back items that are in some cases 5 or even 10 years old.
Oh, sure. And the brands that I talked to, surprisingly enough, admitted to me that that they do encounter that from time to time. So, you know, I certainly don't want to absolve all the higher-end shoppers out there as having, you know, better morals than anybody else. But retailers kind of see that as one of the drawbacks, but just a simple cost of having a policy like this, and believe that the advantages outweigh the disadvantages.
Well, I've seen on the internet, you know, stories of people taking advantage of these policies. There's a REI. This is a Recreational Equipment International, if I have it right. But everyone calls it Rental Equipment International. You know, they'll go camping or something and use something for a trip and bring it back after the weekend.
Yeah, well, it's a very, very, very big risk.
Do they backfire? I mean, how can some – is that sustainable for a business?
Well, in some cases, it might not be. I think the risk of customer abuse is higher when you're talking about a product that is maybe a single-use product or a specialty product, like, say, you know, to cite the camping example. If I'm not a regular camper, but I'm going to go on a camping trip and I don't have any equipment, that sets me up for a perfect opportunity to go out and buy a whole mess of stuff, use it once, and then return it. So an outfitter, for example, like, say, North Face or REI, is going to run a higher risk of that kind of abuse. And some of them will stick with the program, others perhaps not.
Yeah, you did find a list of 15 bold brand promises in your article for Adweek. Among them, some that I found surprising. I mean, Omaha Steaks. I can understand offering guarantees on outdoor clothing, but steaks?
Yeah, I was surprised by that too. But I mean, my guess is that one of the difficulties that any brand has really is differentiating its product. And when you're mail order only, which you know, that company will send you a steak through the mail, you know, the wonders of our time. And you know, if they stand behind it, it's a way for them to stand apart from the competition. So obviously, they've done the math and decided that, from a marketing standpoint, that makes sense for them.
You also have written about brands that offer lifetime guarantees, let's say with an asterisk or a catch, like the luggage company Briggs & Riley. What's their offer?
It's interesting. They really go out on a limb in one sense, in that if your luggage comes back damaged from the airline having mishandled it, they'll repair it. So that was impressive. On the flip side, though, and I guess, you know, this is understandable. They and a number of other brands will not, however, cover what they term normal wear and tear. And also, if I remember correctly, customer abuse. These things can be challenging to define. And even though I understand, certainly from a business point of view, why they would do that, it kind of makes the brands that don't attach any strings all the more impressive.
Huh. It does seem, however, like a lot of these are really established brands. I mean, we're living in an era where new products are popping up all the time. But in order to have a lifetime guarantee that's meaningful, you have to know that store is going to be there, that product is going to be there in a year or 10 years, right?
Absolutely. And I think that kind of cuts both ways because the guarantee not only tells the consumer that the brand is in it for the long haul, but in many cases, the brands with whom I spoke had that guarantee in place since their founding. And in the case of L.L. Bean, that goes back to 1912, and the North Face back to 1968. So sometimes the guarantee is just simply a matter of maintaining what had been a customer service tradition all this time. But I guess the slippery slope here that we should mention is once you extend a guarantee like this, it can be a little bit difficult to back off of it. If you're going to tell the customer that you're in it for the long haul, that you'll back up your stuff, for the lifetime of the product, however you want to term that, you've got all your chips on the table. I mean, you have to play for keeps.
Robert Clara, author and staff writer for Adweek, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
There is a link to read both of his articles about the elusive lifetime guarantee. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Okay, so we heard it there. The lifetime guarantee is a great way for companies to build loyalty and trust, but can backfire if customers abuse the policy. Last year, the outdoor gear company REI, as noted, nicknamed Rental Equipment International by many outdoor enthusiasts, canceled its lifetime guarantee policy because too many customers were returning old, worn gear for brand new replacements. Which brings up the question, can a policy that relies on consumer conscience be sustainable? Should consumers feel guilty about using the lifetime guarantee policy? And do they? Like many New England towns, we have an L.L. Bean outlet just a stone's throw away from our office. So we decided to send producer Zach Nugent around the NHPR office to see if our coworkers had taken advantage of their satisfaction guarantee.
Well, I had a zipper fall off of a fleece in the dryer. Foolishly, I called to see if they would replace the zipper. And essentially, she was like, no, we'll just replace the whole thing.
What was your reaction to that?
Awesome.
Did you feel guilty at all? Because you had this for 5 years.
Well, no, not really.
Okay.
I didn't feel guilty at all. She offered.
I've had these several years. It never occurred to me to return them.
Would you return them?
I probably wouldn't, frankly, just because... but I'm not sure what I mean, you know. I don't know, what would you even get for this?
A new pair, brand new.
Well, maybe next winter. Yeah, I don't know.
I have used the lifetime warranty when, say, like after 2 years, the zipper on a winter jacket broke. And... then I did sort of question the ethics of my decision a little bit.
Well, I actually have never used the lifetime guarantee, but I am a devoted L.L. Bean shopper because they offer it to their customers. I appreciate that fact, and I come back again and again because of it.
Most recently, I had an L.L. Bean headlamp that worked perfectly fine until I dropped it on concrete, and I broke it and brought it in and said, this broke. And that was all I said. This broke. And they said, great. It's sort of like shock that they're willing to do it, but not so much guilt.
I bought a pair of boots probably 3 years ago, but they fell apart. When I go to return the boots, I'll go and shop and buy some more stuff. So it's to their advantage, I think.
I use the lifetime guarantee for my JanSport backpack, which I hadn't been aware that it even had until the zipper broke, and I checked it out and I sent it back in. I think I'd had it for 4 or 5 years at the time, and it's lasted about that long again since.
So did you feel guilty at all about having a backpack for 5 years? That's a long time, and getting a brand new one for free.
No, it's part of the deal. I was very excited, not guilty at all.
Okay, so my coworkers aren't feeling too guilty about returning broken items, even after years of use. But just how far is L.L. Bean willing to take their guarantee? I had to go right to the source to find that out.
My name is Mac McKeever, and I'm a senior public relations representative with L.L. Bean.
Okay, first, can you tell me how the L.L. Bean satisfaction guarantee started?
The satisfaction guarantee started actually over 100 years ago at the start of our company when our founder, Leon Wood Bean, developed the Maine hunting shoe. He went out to market this shoe, and he said, this is the best pair of boots for hunting in Maine and New England and beyond, and I guarantee it. If you're not 100% satisfied with these boots, I'll return your money. So the first 100 orders came in, and 90 of those first 100 pair actually failed. But true to his word, he gave those 90 folks his money back, went back to the drawing board, perfected the boots, and then he truly revolutionized the outdoor footwear industry after that.
All right, well, I have some scenarios that I'm going to read to you, and I want you to tell me whether or not L.L. Bean would accept my return under the satisfaction guaranteed policy.
Okay.
Could I return some L.L. Bean slippers chewed up by the dog?
Yes.
Could I return an L.L. Bean rain jacket that I've had for so long it no longer repels rain?
Absolutely.
L.L. Bean winter hat that I used to decorate a snowman but then forgot about, and it was half eaten by a deer.
Yes.
L.L. Bean gloves that I cut the tops off of so I would look dangerous, yet still be warm while cruising around on my moped.
We would exchange those.
I'm dangling my feet over a volcano, and one of my boots drops in. I rescue it, but severely burned.
We would give you a new pair of boots.
Producer Zach Nugent speaking with Mac McKeever of L.L. Bean. And we'd love to hear your stories of wild returns from the consumer or the retail perspective. Share your dubious return tales on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Coming up on Word of Mouth, a comedian who would probably love to talk to a representative from L.L. Bean. Word of Mouth investigates the lost art of the prank call with Howard Stern regular Jim Florentine. You may remember him from the Comedy Central show Crank Yankers. Well, we'll talk to him in just a minute. Stay with us for that conversation on Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Nowadays, just about everybody has a cell phone. But let's take a moment and think back to the early days of telecommunication when having a phone book still mattered. And we actually knew our friends' numbers by heart. Back then, making a prank call was as easy as picking up the rotary phone and dialing. But between caller ID and unlisted numbers, pranking isn't quite as easy as it used to be. That doesn't mean it is completely disappeared. It's just become more specialized. Word of Mouth senior producer Maureen McMurray brings us this story.
Jim Florentine is a stand-up comic, Howard Stern regular, and host of VH1's That Metal Show. If his name doesn't ring a bell, his voice might. He was one of the guys behind Comedy Central's Crank Yankers, you know, that show about the pranking puppets.
Hi, Rich. It's Bobby Fletcher. I'm calling about the job.
What type of sales experience you got?
I've sold everything over the phone.
Name it. You've done it.
Right.
Well, basically what we're doing here, guy, is dealing specifically with, not specifically, taxes. Are you burping?
What?
All right. So that's a pretty good example of what Jim Florentine does best. Like any good prank caller, he is unflappable. He lets things get to this extremely awkward point and never breaks character. But it's actually his early work in the years before he got a paycheck from pranking that I find most compelling. When he was living with a bunch of buddies in a small apartment, passing the time between stand-up gigs with an ingenious prank.
I originally started doing prank calls when I was a kid because I was always grounded for being bad. So I was stuck in the house and I had nothing better to do than to pick up the phone and just call people and bother them. So I started that as a little kid, and then it morphed into being a comic years later. And you know, as a comedian, I had a show at like 10 o'clock at night. I had nothing going on during the day. So whenever a telemarketer would call, I would just sit by my phone and wait for him, to call. And then I would just try to keep him on the phone as long as possible because I had nowhere to go. So I would try to keep him on the phone for like an hour if I could.
Hello?
Hello, James?
Yeah.
I'm giving you a call from credit counselor.
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah.
Hey, dude, you still on the phone?
Yeah, I'm still on the phone.
Okay.
Hello?
All right, do you have a few moments? Or?
Yeah, I have a few moments, yeah.
Yo, you still on the phone?
Yeah.
Okay. Bank consolidation is a program.
Yo, you still on, dude? Yeah.
You on the phone?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, if you want, I can give you a call back.
No, this is fine, actually. I got to run out to work a little bit, so I'd rather get this over with now. It was what? Developed what?
Debt consolidation is a program.
Yo, you still on? Yeah.
Okay.
Turns out those calls that he made for his own enjoyment to pass the time between stand-up gigs is what wound up putting him on the map. Howard Stern caught wind of his pranks, and Jim put out a 5-volume series of these pranks called Terrorizing Telemarketers. And he made all of these pranks with one thing in mind. Keep the telemarketers on the line as long as possible. And keeping them on the line actually wasn't that hard.
And, you know, they just had 10 people in a row going, you know, F you, don't ever call here again. So they finally get somebody on the phone. They're like, wow, somebody's actually listening and I got somebody. So they're excited.
Did you find that there was a typical response that you would get?
Well, my whole thing was, you know, if they were ready to leave, you know, get off the call and say, look, sir, we'll just call you tomorrow or we'll... I got to go. Just like my whole thing was, I'm just trying to get the information. I don't know how this works.
This is frustrating.
I'm reading from the strip, and I know exactly what I just stated.
The part right before the debt relief you said, what was that?
We are the exclusive agent.
No,
no. You're throwing me for loops right here, and that's all that I have stated.
Okay, but you said that one 3 times. I told you that wasn't it.
Okay, then let me go on to proceed further then.
Okay.
Now, because we are a nonprofit company.
No.
Now, because we are a nonprofit company, we are able to guarantee...
It's not that... No, it's not that part, though. I heard that.
I'm moving on from that.
No.
Well, bye, sir, because you still had to know, and I can't... I'm not taking this from you today.
She hung up.
And that's it. Without cursing, without resorting to threats, Jim simply plays dumb to the point of making the harasser the harassed. It's remarkable and it's hilarious. I laughed the first time I heard it. I still think it's funny. But is it mean? Am I mean for thinking it's funny? Do you ever feel a bit bad for some of these people?
No, because they rip people off. Most of their plans are bogus. You know, they're scams. They're bothering people all the time. They rip off old people constantly. You know, what about the people like, go F you, don't ever call here again, I hate you. You know, that's got to make somebody feel bad on the, you know, the telemarketer, like, oh my God, everybody hates me.
Okay, well, maybe he does have a point, but does it even matter? I mean, why does the prankster have to bear the burden of guilt in the scenario? But what happens when the prank goes too far? I mean, even Jim admits he doesn't know where the line is, and his line, it is way different from ours.
Even with the telemarketer calls, you just never know. Like, there was another telemarketer call that went wrong where my credit card company called me up and said, look, we can transfer $10,000 from my credit card into your bank account in case, you know. And I'm like, okay, and I'm listening. I'm like, all right. She goes, and then all of a sudden she goes, you know, in case something comes up, maybe you needed the money. And right away when she said that, I go, oh, you know, that's perfect. Because I just hit this old lady with my car and I got to pay her medical bills.
I just found out I hit that old lady. That hit and run, but...
Oh, well, I hope everything works out all right for you.
Yeah, everything's fine with me. I don't know what's going on with her.
Mm.
Well, she's old.
Now, did you have any other balances out there that you wanted to pay off?
Yeah, because you know what? I'm going to have to pick up this old bag's medical expenses.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman's like, okay. And I'm like, let me go over these bills real quick. Let me see if this works because this might be good. And then I just started making stuff up. I said, yeah, I visited her at the hospital and I knocked her teeth out. So I got to buy her new teeth. How much are new teeth? Like fake teeth. And the woman's actually going over the prices with me over the phone.
We can take care of that for you right now unless you would like me to try you back at a later time.
No. I mean, I'm just trying to figure this all out if you can give me a second.
Okay.
The dentures, what would you say that goes for?
I couldn't tell you how much the dentures will cost.
All right, so the hearing aid is, I don't know, what do you say, $1,000 for 2 of them, maybe?
Yeah, maybe.
$1,500?
Maybe a little bit more than that.
All right, let's go $2,000 with
okay.
it.
Okay.
Finally, at the end of the call, she's like, okay, what's your account number so we could transfer the money? Now, I don't want them to transfer the money, obviously, so now I got to get out of it. So I'm thinking, how can I get out of this? So I just blurted it out. I go,
you know what? $7,050 I got to pay for this. I think it's just cheaper to just go kill her. Hello?
Okay. I can admit that probably is a line crossed for most people. I was uncomfortable. But in his defense, I will speak in his defense, I mean, this wasn't planned. And he just said the first thing that came into his mind. And as a professional comedian, sometimes what's on the top of your mind might be dark. I mean, you push boundaries for a living. So what wound up happening here is the woman hangs up the phone. Jim thinks, all right, I got out of that situation. She didn't transfer the money into my account. Everything's good. Prank is a success. And then this happens.
And 45 minutes later, I got two detectives at my door because it was my credit card company that had my address right in front of them. The woman believed it, that I, you know, that I was going to go kill this woman in a hospital. And I, two detectives were knocking on my door. And they, you know, came in and started searching my house and looking in rooms because I thought there was like an old lady's dead body in there. And now I'm trying to explain to them, like, look, I do these prank calls. I work on this show called Crank Anchors. And they had my license. They're looking at it, checking everything out. And the guy just looked at it. He goes, you're 32 years old. What is wrong with you?
But here's the thing. Jim's in his 40s now, and he has a wife and a kid. And he's still making prank calls. He's still a stand-up comic. And I bet he still thinks that joke is funny. He'll probably always think that joke is funny. But thank goodness for someone like Jim. Because you know what? The prank call, in the way that we knew it as kids, is dead. We have caller ID. We have phone tracking systems. We have unlisted numbers. Those innocent prank calls we made as kids, those don't exist anymore. Maybe a good prank needs someone like Jim Florentine who will say the things that we won't. And we'll go to the places we won't. And we'll go to the lengths that we just won't to get a laugh. All in the name of keeping prank call alive.
Just doing my thing.
Maureen McMurray there, speaking with professional prankster and stand-up comic Jim Florentine. About 2 years ago, Facebook bought the photo-sharing app Instagram for somewhere around $1 billion. Critics and media watchers balked at the price and wondered if Facebook would get its money's worth. Last week, Mark Zuckerberg announced an even higher-priced acquisition, buying the virtual reality company Oculus VR for $2 billion. This may be the first time that non-gamers are hearing about the Oculus Rift. Jamin Warren, founder of Killscreen, a video game culture magazine, is with us to explain why Facebook has put so much stock in virtual reality. Jamin, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Hello, how are you doing?
Very well. Listeners who may have heard about this acquisition may not know much about Oculus Rift itself. So can you describe, you know, how you use it, what it looks like?
Sure. So the Oculus Rift device is a virtual reality headset. It's very, very light. And probably people had some experience with virtual reality in the 90s. At the time, the technology wasn't really there to create the types of experiences that you can create now. But it was developed by a teenager from Southern California named Palmer Luckey, who had put together some off-the-part shelves to create a virtual reality system sort of from scratch. He took that to Kickstarter, raised about $2.5 million, which then paved the way for creating a company, took on some VC investment from some heavy hitters in the Valley, and that kind of paved the way for an acquisition. Although I don't think anyone thought it was going to happen quite so quickly.
Have you ever tried one on? How do you do it?
I have. It's pretty easy. I mean, it's like putting on a pair of, if you've ever gone scuba diving or something like that, it's roughly about the same experience. You strap it to your head, and then you have to bring your own headphones, so there aren't any headphones that are attached to it.
What's the experience like once you put this headset on?
I was admittedly very skeptical before I tried it out, simply because, you know, I, like many people, had kind of tried VR in the 90s when I was a kid. And, it's really, really cool. I mean, it's rare that I try a new piece of technology that feels like it's going to fundamentally alter the way that I experience media. But that certainly is the case with the Oculus. For anyone who's tried it, I mean, it recreates certain types of experiences that I think would be very, very hard to capture. Like flying, for example. I mean, that's like a pretty simple one that people have dreamed about, which it just feels so much more realistic with an Oculus Rift headset. It's a pretty amazing device.
Wow. Well, Facebook's purchase of Oculus VR, that's the company behind the Rift, has sparked an ugly backlash. What's behind that?
Sure. Well, I think there's two different sides to it. One is from the Kickstarter backers. You know, as you know, the Kickstarter, part of the narrative of Kickstarter is that you go there because, you know, traditional funding sources aren't available to you. And creators and founders, they sell this vision that we really need your help, right? And the end outcome of this is that the $2.5 million that went into the company benefits the VC and the investors who put money in later, not the original Kickstarter backers. Now, all the Kickstarter people signed up for is to get a virtual reality headset, the dev kit, which has been available for sale for the past year. But I think there's this sense that the money that went in wasn't necessarily for this big $2 billion exit. The other the other sentiment of the backlash comes from, I think, from gamers who, you know, for a long time, I think, and this is a longer sort of a longer conversation, but, you know, gamers are often treated as being, you know, backwater or not interested in the future of technology. And there's a sense that sort of the party's over, specifically for independent game designers who maybe were pinning their hopes to it. So, you know, because Facebook is this huge, you know, huge Fortune 500 company, there's a sense that this scrappy little upstart was kind of was smothered in its infancy. I don't necessarily see it that way, but that's where the backlash is coming from.
The Oculus Rift is certainly not yet a mass market item, but you mentioned there are these dev kits, development kits that people are using. What are some of the ways that the Oculus Rift has been used besides gaming?
Yeah, I've seen a couple amazing prototypes. I know from the world of games, I tried it was a space fighting game called Eve Valkyrie, which is amazing. I've never operated something that felt like it was in 3D space. There was a Canadian musician who used it to record a song. You basically show up in the room, you put on the headset, and he sits down at a camera, and then you can rotate and look all the way around stage. I mean, Chris Milk, the director, has used it to record Beck, the musician Beck, live on stage. So you can pop on an Oculus Rift headset and watch Beck play. It's as if you're right there next to him. You know, there's a lot of potential here. Tourism is one that, you know, I think I'm very excited about. I'm never going to climb Mount Everest, but it's possible for me to maybe experience that by proxy. Or, you know, I'm not going to have courtside seats to the Final Four, but, you know, the Oculus Rift does open the possibility for me to experience those things by proxy, and a very convincing proxy at that.
Well, any idea of how Mark Zuckerberg and a social network like Facebook would use it?
Yeah, I think that's the big question that everyone has. I mean, admittedly, there are some concerns there. Facebook doesn't have a track record with hardware. This is a hardware device. You know, Facebook's business model is advertising supported. Right now, you know, the Oculus Rift was chiefly designed for people to sell experiences. I think what it reflects is Oculus fits into, I think, a larger philosophical framework for Facebook. Facebook wants to be the center of your communication world. They want to control all the different ways that you interact with the outside world. And I think that they're looking at virtual reality the same way that someone might have looked at, say, smartphones, say, 10, 15 years ago. I don't think that the Oculus Rift is going to be the only virtual reality device, but Facebook wants to jump to the head of the line and start looking for ways to integrate it into their existing package, whether it's with Instagram or with Facebook or with WhatsApp or whatever that might be. This might ostensibly be one of the delivery mechanisms for Facebook products, the same way that Facebook develops things for mobile. So, you know, time will tell. It's certainly a speculative investment at some level, but Facebook is, you know, it was a mostly stock deal, so they're not putting a lot of cash up front to purchase the company. And, you know, obviously Facebook has been on quite a buying spree over the past 12 to 18 months.
Damon Warren is with us. He's founder and editor-in-chief of Killscreen, a video game culture magazine and website. Is this strategic on Facebook's part? Are they trying to get an upper hand or maybe trying to gain a little bit of an edge on wearable technology like Google Glass, that sort of thing?
So one of the interesting things about the Oculus is that, you know, in terms of a piece of technology, there are some breakthroughs with existing pieces and existing patents, but it's not like what Facebook is buying is something like Apple, for example. They own, you know, patents for slide to refresh and multi-touch, and obviously have been embroiled in big lawsuits about new technologies like with Samsung, etc. That's not the case with Oculus. And so I think this deal, what it represents is two things. I think one is that the Oculus Rift, there's going to be competition in that space, and I think Oculus certainly knows that. And the flip side is that Facebook wants to, you know, remain in the vanguard of what's cool, new, and interesting. And, you know, in some ways they get more PR out of these acquisitions than they do when they roll out new incremental updates to the news feed, for example. So it might be a weird way to spend, you know, $2 billion, but given that it was leveraged mostly by stock, not by cash up front, yeah, I think you could look at it as a way that Facebook wants to be ahead of the curve and maybe gobble up Oculus before somebody else does, an Apple, a Microsoft, or a Google.
Damon Warren, founder and editor-in-chief of Killscreen. That's a video game culture magazine and website. Thank you very much for your time.
Of course, anytime. Let me tell
you. you for spending a little bit of your weekend with Word of Mouth. If you do like what you heard, there's much more to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us. You can send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more on Monday at noon, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.